Hi, I'm Eloise Skinner, and welcome back to the Legal Cheek podcast. And today we're talking to Richard Yule from Skadden. Some of you guys might have heard of him before because he's been on a few Legal Cheek events. But today we're going to be talking about his background and his career in law, and also asking some general questions about passion and purpose and ambition and that kind of thing. But I want to give Richard an opportunity to introduce himself. So Richard or Rich?
Rich, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not in trouble with my mum, so it's Rich.
Rich. Okay, maybe just say like a little bit about your background and how you got here, and yeah.
A little bit about my background takes quite a long time. So Richard, I'm a partner at Skadden. I do private equity work. I was formerly a partner at Y&K, so I was formerly a partner at Linklaters before that, and then I also worked at SJ Berwin, at Eversheds in Leeds, and Stamp Jackson and Proctor in Hull. So I've been knocking around for quite a lot of years.
Yeah, yeah. How many places is that? Like 10?
Five, isn't it? Five or six. That's yeah. So it was not an not an orthodox route into being, well, in the magic circle was the first main stopping point. So I got a 2-2 from Newcastle University, which is obviously not the way into city law firms traditionally, but I got a training contract at Stamp Jackson and Proctor, and then moved on from there at the end of my training contract, 2 years in Leeds, about a year and a half at SJ Berwin, then my boss joined Linklaters and I followed him there.
It's a pretty cool journey. And I want to go right back to the beginning. So what made you, before you were even studying law, what made you want to be a lawyer? What was your first career ambition before that?
Well, I was going to be a footballer, but obviously wasn't good enough. And then I was going to be a fireman, and then I wasn't going to be a fireman for some reason. I can't remember why. My mum suggested I should do a law degree when I said I was going to do a history degree. I had an uncle who was an author who wrote, he edited a thing called Prison Writing. He was a probation officer, and I used to hang around with him in school holidays and stuff, and we'd go and meet his clients or we'd go and meet his barrister mates. And so I was actually more originally interested in criminal law and that side of things. And then on a work experience thing, when I was 16 at school, they sent me to the Stamp Jackson Proctor law firm, and I got on well with people there. So when I applied for the training contract, however many years later that was, because I'd been there before, you kind of got in.
Yeah.
And it was just from that, really, and it was, I didn't have a lot of other bright ideas at that stage about what I was going to do, so it just seemed like a good place to start.
Yeah.
I didn't have a burning desire to be a corporate lawyer or anything approximating that. I was interested in criminal law, and we were just talking before about the secret barrister and that side of kind of criminal justice I find really interesting, but obviously that's not necessarily, you got to want to go down that road of being a barrister or a criminal lawyer, and that didn't appeal to me much either, having spent time with barristers.
Yeah, so where was there like a turning point between the criminal law to corporate law kind of path?
I think it was just starting working and doing different things at Stamp Jackson and Proctor. So we did like personal injury litigation, medical negligence litigation, conveyancing, commercial litigation, corporate work. So a whole range of things there, and a tiny bit of kind of matrimonial and criminal. And it was obvious at that time that if you wanted, litigation was looking challenged. It was like the Wolf Reform. So litigators were starting to panic about, was there going to be a role for litigators anymore, which obviously has proven to be that there is. But we were like family litigators, personal injury litigators. So it was low end stuff, which the Wolf Reforms talked about eradicating. So corporate seemed like the natural thing to do. And basically the Leeds firms at that time would hire anybody with a work ethic who weren't tremendously thick. So I just about, I passed the work ethic test. I'm not sure about the tremendously thick.
And I wonder, because I also wanted to, when I was younger, I wanted to maybe go into more like private client or criminal or something that wasn't corporate. And I wondered if you think there's a real cultural difference between working in an environment that's like corporate or commercial law and working in a different type of law. Like, could you see personality fit in different ways? Because I know a lot of students are thinking like, which way should I go? What would more suit my skill set, but also my like personality and a cultural fit as well?
I looked at it and thought that if you wanted to be at the top in like the criminal law area, then you probably needed to be a barrister, which is probably not a correct view, but that was a view I had at the time. And I didn't really fancy that kind of self-employed life. And I wasn't particularly confident with kind of public speaking. And that's whenever I didn't go to one of those sort of schools where you learn how to speak public and have that kind of confidence level. So it was more natural for me to go into a day-to-day people environment. And I think you need, what I found with the on the corporate side, which I wasn't expecting, was that you just met good people who I got on well with. So it just felt like a good environment. You know, you're getting monthly paid, you've got a good flow of work, you're getting good experience, you can find people that you find inspirational in some way. So I think it's a bit your personality type, mm-hmm. probably a bit your skill set in terms of what you feel confident doing, and then also, you know, just what are you interested in doing.
Yeah. And I think throughout your career, because you've been to so, like, you've had so many different stages, I guess, of your career, would you say that you're driven by a sense of ambition, or is it like you have an overarching purpose that you're kind of just going for, or has it just evolved naturally? Like, what's...
I think it's evolved, and then when you look back on it, you can say there must have been an ambition point when you talked about it. So from Hull to Leeds made a lot of sense, because at the time when I moved to Leeds, Leeds was the clear number two legal market in the UK. It was a clear number two for corporate work. But then I met someone and who was also from Hull who led the private equity team, so it was a total fluke that I happened to work for him. He took me under his wing because I'd worked at a firm in Hull. I think then from Leeds, it's obvious you would want to come to London if you wanted to push on to, you know, better clients, bigger deals, more complicated legal work. And also I wanted to live in London. Mm. My sister was down here, so it was natural that I would come to London. And by that point, you kind of specialise and focus in something, and you can then see you're in that job, you're in that environment, where's the better work, where's the better thing for your career? So you, at that point, there's ambition to it. But I wouldn't say I was like ferociously ambitious as I was going through, but you just kind of get in the job. If you enjoy it, you feel like you're developing, you can see it's going somewhere. It's a great career to be in from that point of view.
Yeah. And would you also say that you over time developed like a real confidence, like in your own skill set, putting yourself forwards? Because I'm thinking, coming from a background that's not, like you said, one of these schools, which I also had a similar background where I just felt a bit out of my depth in these kind of environments, like what would you say to people who are looking to, who are maybe like lacking in confidence but wanting to?
I think the beauty of being in a in environments like SJ Berwin was, like Linklaters was or whatever, is there are great people around you. I think the number one thing you have to have is a work ethic. Mm. And then I think provided that you are prepared to make yourself look a bit stupid, then, and provided that you have an opportunity to do the same things on a repeat basis, not that much of it is super complicated. It's obviously super complicated when you first come up against it, but it's not super complicated times three, times four.
Yeah.
And if you're picking things up and you're working hard, then you feel like you're developing and it's worth it. I think there's a, I never had like a chip on my shoulder about whether I was smart enough or not. I had a chip on my shoulder about whether my accent was right, whether people want to listen to my voice. And then over time, you just, you go through things over and over and you build the confidence up and you just got to get over yourself. At the end of the day, yeah. A chip on your shoulder is a chip on something to be knocked off.
Yeah.
And you
yeah.
can you can manage and work that through yourself, but you need people around you that will help you do that. And it doesn't mean to say they're sitting there going, I'm now going to stop Rich thinking he sounds like an idiot. It just means they're supportive of you and they help you and they supervise you and delegate properly, and then you feel like you're developing.
Mm. And I guess there's also a sense of resilience in kind of like maybe coming up against challenges throughout. Like I know at the Legal Cheek event that we were both at, someone asked a question about like failure. And I always find this quite difficult because I think, especially when you're more junior and you're starting to fail quite regularly on like just in the course of your normal career, because things are hard and things move really fast, especially in these kind of environments, and people do make mistakes. So what would you say to people who are looking to develop more of a sense of resilience?
I think that I read someone on Twitter the other day that said that failure was just a form of feedback, and I think that's right. You can't be expected to do significantly broad tasks within a deal environment. You have to break them down, right? And good supervision is breaking down jobs and parceling up into sizes that people can manage. And I think if you are doing an appropriately kind of sized and scoped piece of work and you're doing it on a repeat basis and you're constantly getting it wrong, then that's kind of utopia of how you develop. But if you're totally getting it wrong, then maybe you've got to look at it and say, is this, am I in the right place here for me as a person? I think though, if you don't necessarily get work that's parceled up to the right size. So if you're getting tasks that are just too big and beyond your level, then that's not your fault. You know, if you're not supervised properly, you're not getting feedback and constructive feedback, that's not your fault. If you're not getting sufficient time to do things, you can't expect perfection in, you know, half the amount of time that it's going to take you to do a job, that's not your fault. So you have to, I think you have to grade your failure. If you kind of just don't get something, and you've had time, and you've had supervision, and the ability to do your training, then maybe it isn't the right thing for you. But if you have had those things, you know, then you really should be thriving and developing.
Yeah. So is it like, what kind of practical ways can you kind of, I love that idea of like grading your failure and like actually analysing it and seeing what's happened and using it as a form of feedback. But in a practical way, does that mean like asking your boss to sit down for a chat, or does it mean like reflecting on your own?
I think it's both. It's both of those things. Yeah. I mean, the main thing that you need to do is be organised, right? So every job that you get, you can break it down into a number of parts. It might be 100, it might be 50, it might be 5. You have to be able to understand each of those subparts to it. And I think the acid test is whether you can explain it to somebody or not. Mm-hmm. If you can't explain it to somebody, like your mum or your brother or whoever, then if you can't explain it, you don't really understand it. And you have to have that ability to break things down and then to really work and understand it and piece it together. The stuff that we do, it deals with kind of 100 elements to it, let's say, but 90 of them we've done before. Mm-hmm. And each of those 90, you can break those down into subtasks, but the 90 of them you've done before in some shape or other. So there's only 10 that we may be outside of our total comfort zone on. But again, we can break those down. And I think if you spend the time to break them down, and if you're the people you're working with spend the time to explain and break things down, then that gives you the chance then to build it from the bottom. But you can't start on the middle floor, you've got to start on the bottom and work your understanding up through those different aspects.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting actually, and especially about explaining it to other people, because one thing I've noticed as I've become a bit more senior at work is like now having to explain a task to someone else to get them to do it actually gives me an appreciation of the task that I never had before. So maybe a tip for junior lawyers is like, even if you don't have to explain it to someone else because you're doing it yourself, like it's still a good practice to go through and maybe even like talk it through with your boss or like another person on the team and get yourself to do it.
But the whole business of law is built on leverage, right? So it's built on getting jobs done by people at appropriate levels and appropriate cost base. It's how law firms, you know, make profit ultimately, is by getting the right people to do the right jobs and they can charge them to clients. So the whole system should be about breaking jobs down so they can be done by more junior people on the team, but then building those more junior people up who can then explain to then more junior people what they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
And Danny Baker came out with this quote about the unmarried marriage guidance counsellor, which came across years ago. And you can't explain to somebody how to do something unless you've really done it yourself.
Yeah.
I now have the other problem, which is I've forgotten how to do things. So I'm entirely reliant on the fact that for my senior associates that I develop them properly and that they can explain and delegate appropriately to the more junior people in our team.
Yeah.
So it's a constant cycle. But you need time and space to be able to develop. You've also got to recognise, though, if having been given the appropriate conditions, if you're just not developing. And I think we all too often think that the job not being for you is a sign of failure. I'm not sure it is. Mm. I think it's just a sign maybe that the job's not for you.
Right.
And I don't view that as like a dirty word. I just think this job is very demanding and you need to know that you're progressing and that you get it. And that is internal reflection.
Yeah.
You kind of know whether it's interesting. You kind of know whether you're getting it or not, or whether you're just constantly struggling. And so that you ask the question about how much that is just reflecting on yourself. And I think there is definitely an element about, you know, is it for me, that you should always think about that.
So in terms of today's junior lawyers, what do you think are the kind of challenges or the developments in the profession that they should be aware of? Like, what are the biggest changes that you see from a senior perspective for today's juniors?
I think one of the biggest challenges is just time. It's how long do teams of lawyers have to deliver projects to clients? I think with the advent of tech, I mean, I remember when I just had my first kid, who's now 15, which dates this, I was the first managing associate at Linklaters to get a BlackBerry. And I thought this was like some badge of honour, like on my 2 weeks paternity leave. And really all it was they wanted to make sure I was contactable during paternity leave, which I was absolutely fine with. I didn't have a problem with that at all. But starting kind of from then and moving to today, I mean, the need for instant has never been greater. And I think it's a challenge for law firms to ensure that their junior associates and trainees and whatever, and senior associates have time to do the job they need to do and to the right level. Because ultimately, if you're rushed, then you will not get things, you know, to an acceptable level of quality. So I think law firms are looking at that, right, about how they can use technology to make themselves more efficient. I think the media and maybe law firm management looks at that from a cost perspective. I think it's more enabling people to get around the ground quicker. So I was at lunch today with a trainee who's just finished his first seat in our team, and he was explaining his wizardry on Excel. So he was he did military service. He's a South Korean guy, did military service in the army over there, and had a desk-based job, and so spent his entire time doing logistics on Excel. So he's an absolute wizard. So you can, if you understand Excel, then you can do funds flows much more efficiently. Funds flows can't be wrong. It's not, there's no error, no margin of error in a funds flow, even on a rounding basis. So kind of developing those kind of skills to enable you to work more efficiently, I think is something law firms need to invest in.
Yeah.
Like in my day, I used to do funds flows literally on a piece of A4. And it was only getting one dramatically wrong and having to go and rectify a bunch of registered members of like 10 different companies in some holding structure that said there's got to be a smarter way of doing this. And then we kind of moved to Word, you know, but we were still like in calculator land, and you'd be like adding up 50 different figures and you do it 10 times and have two in common. So that would be the one you went with.
Yeah,
you know, it's like the yeah. ways of working are smarter. Law firms need to do that to give themselves, their associates, more time to do things.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a different skill set, I think, for juniors than certainly what I had.
Yeah, definitely. And do you think, so in terms of the hours, you mentioned like the advent of the BlackBerry as well, which I'm proud to say I was an owner of a BlackBerry for like 6 months. Yeah, so I'm still half a foot in that generation.
Useless on games though, and listening to Spotify and podcasts and all that.
Yeah, they were very work focused. They were. Disappointing.
Yeah.
So do you reckon that now, like in terms of the work-life balance, is it better or worse? Because I remember some partners in our firm when we joined saying like, oh, and now you have a phone so you can leave the office. And like, we used to have to stay here and do due diligence until like 3 a.m. But obviously now you maybe check your phone at 3 a.m. So what do you think, it's worse or better or the same?
I think
same but different.
I think it's better and worse. I think overall it's worse.
Yeah.
Because I think the like the pervasion of your job into all aspects of your life is kind of, I don't know when it would have really have started, but you know, 10 years ago or something. I mean, everybody's tech enabled, everybody can work at home, everybody can log on, everybody does have a phone and is reachable.
Mm.
Everyone gets their emails constantly. And so I think it's more all pervasive. So there's definitely an adjustment you need to make in terms of allowing work into your non-work life. But it's always a question of degree. And I think in big law, the expectation is that you are, you know, available unless there's very clear times when you're not and you've communicated those very clearly. It doesn't make it right, but it kind of is the environment that it is.
Yeah. So
and it's not going to change.
Yeah.
You're not going to unwind it. You're not going to uninvent the BlackBerry and the iPhone and all those sorts of things. So it's a question of how you help people. So where I find it odd is that we expect people to be available 24/7, but if they say they want to work at home on a given Wednesday or whatever, then and people don't like that, I think that's very strange, because I don't think you can have it all ways round. If you're going to expect people to be available 24/7, then you have to also give them an opportunity to have a lie-in, get the fridge fitted or fixed, you know, get some Amazon deliveries, or you know, go for a run or do whatever it is that they want. You can't have it all ways.
Right. And what would you say, like obviously flexible working is one thing, or just working in a way that kind of is more tailored to your schedule, what are some other kind of practical ways that you have found help in terms of this all-on environment? Like how do you...
I think you have to be very clear with people when you are not available to work. I think it's kind of a self-preservation kind of thing where you've got to say there are some boundaries here which I can't get over. And I think we're all able to cope with it when someone says they're on holiday or someone's got some religious time out they need to take, or they're getting married, or they're at a funeral, I think you have to look at it and say, right, this week I'm available, but I'm not available at these certain times, and put those barriers up. And the teams that you're working in should be able to deal with that. There's a real world, though, you have to accept, which is if you're in the middle of a deal process and you're integral to that deal, then you just have to be available.
Mm.
So it's kind of flexible, but it's kind of not in extremis flexible.
Yeah, I think it's hard because it's like I those deal pressures that I was just thinking back to my time as a trainee, and this kind of feeling of having to be all on, and especially in a transactional environment where, like you said, you do have periods where you really can't step down. And I think as a junior lawyer, there's so much pressure on you to just be present and available all the time that it's quite hard to, like, it's easier to talk about boundaries from a position of seniority, I think. And I don't know whether junior lawyers now feel like they can sort of say, and how they can sort of set those kind of communication boundaries with people.
I think it's, I mean, there's a real world of the job, right? Which is, if you come and work for a firm like mine or any of the other, you know, elite end European or US firms, and you have signed up for that life.
Yeah.
And I think you have to be realistic with yourself that you've done that. But if there are things that you want or need to do, then you're not going to get anywhere by not communicating them, you know, and sitting there and risking either not telling people and then just not being available and that annoying them, you know, or else telling people and that annoying them. But I think you have to, if you want people to be available 24/7, then you have to address flexibility in how they work, and you can't manage it unless you're told about it. Mm. And this is something I say to my guys, which is my team, which is, you don't tell me about it, I can't do anything about it. If you do tell me about it, I may not be able to do anything about it. But if I don't know about it, I definitely can't.
Right, right.
So I think it's a communication process.
And in terms of the junior people in your team and just junior lawyers in general, what would be your kind of main piece of guidance or wisdom, aside from the many pieces you've already given us? Like, what's your main kind of takeaway?
I think that you have to... because things move so fast, you tend to think that there isn't time. I think you've always got more time to develop as a person, to do the work that you've got in front of you, than what people allow themselves now. We live in a very instant world. You want something, you go into your phone and you order it from Amazon and it comes the next day. You know, I think that's generally how we all live our lives. Everyone's multitasking constantly. You watch a movie, you're on your phone, you know, on Twitter or whatever it is that you do, Instagram or whatever it is that you do. I think you have to give your career time to develop. And not everyone's at the same point at the same moment in time. And not everybody has everything explained to them or trained in consistent ways. So I think time is the main thing. You take time to think about how you're developing and what you want to do and where you want to be.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have a final question for you. I have not prepared you for this in advance, so right. I was just wondering, obviously because your career has been really interesting in so many different ways, actually when I was doing research, in inverted commas, for this interview, you were described as like a stratospheric rise to the position you're in today. I wondered if you write, when you write your autobiography, which I'm definitely going to read, what would the title be? What would it be called?
I don't know what it would be called. I think what you...
The journey.
The one thing about my career that stands out is that I went from the kind of firm I started in, which is in itself a great firm, to a different kind of firm, which is recognised in a different sort of a way. The consistent thing about each and every one of those firms and those experiences that I had great bosses or senior people that I worked with and for. And without that, those people around you, you literally are going to go nowhere, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. No one's a true self-starter. I look at kind of how we ever got our clients. I didn't like click my fingers and the clients arrived. I was introduced to them over time and over different deals and interactions. And, you know, a lot of that is not so much luck as fortune, but you have to surround yourself with people that are interested in your development. And I think if you do that, then you can go wherever you want to go. The beauty of the legal career is it gives you so many choices. And I think you should always think, what choices have I got now? I mean, I've made my choices and that's fine, but for more junior lawyers, you should always stop and think, what choices have I got now? Am I developing such that I've got choice? And if you've got that, then you can take this career where you want to go.
So would it be called The Choice?
It would be called, I don't know what it would be called. You're the author, yeah. Not me.
I'll think about it and get back to you.
All right.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And yeah, that was really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.